Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I had never heard of today's guest until recently. I suppose that's not really unusual, given that over 2.7 million Americans served in Vietnam. But it does seem like a little bit of radio malpractice that a guy like me, who does a show about members of our military, wasn't at least a little familiar with the story of a fellow who was awarded no less than 5 Distinguished Flying Cross medals while flying in F-4 Phantoms over Vietnam. As I was preparing for today's show, at first I thought of looking for poems appropriate to introduce a hero, but as I came to know more about this man, it became readily apparent that he would be likely to shy away from that title. He is the classic, I was just doing my job kind of guy, and so much more. Simply doing prep for today's interview, I already feel myself a better person for coming to know this man and his story. I believe you will, too, after hearing from him. Lieutenant Colonel Marion Anthony Marshall, we are very proud to have you on American Warrior Radio today.
Good morning, Ben. How are you?
I'm just terrific. And first off, sir, welcome home.
Thank you.
Now, if I can call you Tony?
Yes, you may.
All right. So you were born in T.C. but raised on a tobacco farm. Your mother, though, Tony, had grander plans for you than being a tobacco farmer, right?
Oh, yes. She always said, you're going to do better than I did.
And what was the plan?
The plan was to go to college. And that was the stepping stone to start off. So, I don't know. She had mixed emotions because I kind of indicated that I wanted to be a pilot because I thought pilots were cool. But I figured I had about the same chance of being Superman and being a pilot. And her famous words were, if you know what I know, you'd stay your butt on the ground. And if God had meant for you to fly, he'd have gave you wings. But then she would buy model airplanes for me, bring home magazine articles about airplanes, and take me out to the airport to let me hang on the fence and watch airplanes.
Now, Tony, were you brothers and sisters, big family?
Small family, just one sister.
Okay. And would you then be the first of your family to go to college?
I'm the first on my family tree to, not the first to go to college, first in my immediate family, but obviously the first to go to a military academy, the first to be a pilot, and all that sort of nonsense.
How did you get, I mean, because not anyone gets to go to a military academy. You received a congressional appointment, is that correct?
I did. I read an article when I was my junior year in high school that was about the academy, and it said, you are nobody here, and that gave me a challenge. I mentioned that to most of my teachers, and they all, of course, wanted me to go to an HBCU, historically black college, and be a big fish in a small pond. But luckily, one of my guidance counselors said, get out of town, go somewhere else, and be a small fish in a big pond. So I applied, and the story is quite humorous, I think, because I applied to all of the congressmen I could. The one senator completely ignored my letter. The other one said my scores were too low, he couldn't possibly consider me. And my representative was very technically correct, I would say, politically correct, because he said he had already filled his slot. And luckily, the congressman at large gave me a chance to interview. And I think he had 125 people come on Friday, 125 come on Saturday. And I was the only dark spot in that group. But the final question they asked me was, how are you going to handle prejudice at the academy? And my answer was, from what I've read about the academy, everybody would be too busy doing their duty to even worry about prejudice. So I guess that was the right answer.
So you, being such an outstanding student, you excelled in your first semester there, huh?
Oh, yeah. I almost flunked out.
Well,
I had no clue about studying because I skated through high school.
Uh-huh.
I got by on the family reputation. And it took me a full semester, well, a full year to understand how to study. And I pulled my grades up and survived. because they told me when I went home for Christmas that I wouldn't be coming back.
Well, Tony, you of all people know it's not about how many times a guy falls down, but how many times they pick themselves up again.
Quite true.
So the other thing I found interesting in researching your background, you were not a big athletic kind of guy. So I didn't realize you could do this, but one of my favorite visits ever to the Air Force Academy, sir, was when they let us personally meet the mascot, the Falcon. And
right.
So that's what you did, right? Instead of fencing or diving or football?
Yeah, I chose to be a Falconer because I couldn't swim. And, of course, they put me on the water polo team as punishment. But
literally.
When I tried out for golf, the guy said my swing was all awkward, to forget it. So I'd out for gymnastics, and they said, you'll never make it. So in order to minimize my exposure to sports, I decided to become a Falconer.
How early in your career, Tony, did you realize that being a pilot was not going to be initially an option for you?
Actually, it didn't come until my senior year. And we drew lots to see who would get I think there were 40 slots. And I couldn't go. My roommate went for me, and he drew number 250 or something like that. So that was out. And because my eyes had gone bad, they said, forget it. So I chose navigator training instead, just to be in the airplane. But I always wanted to be a pilot. And they eventually relaxed the rules and said you can wear glasses. So I finally got my chance.
And walking through that, it's sort of an interesting story. You, the F-4, which is one of my favorite aircraft, probably for all the wrong reasons, but she's a beast. You were not enamored with that aircraft initially.
Well, actually, I was.
Okay.
I loved it. I just didn't like being in the back seat.
Okay.
But the good thing was the Air Force made a mistake and put controls in the back seat, so I learned to fly while I was back there. The Navy did not put controls back there, so good choice not to go to the Navy.
Tony, we're just approaching the first break, and I just so much about your story that I appreciate, and I truly meant that, sir, when I said I wish I'd met you sooner in life, because there's so much to be learned from your story. You were one of, I believe, only 6 black cadets in your Air Force Academy class of over 1,000. Is that about
That's
right?
Correct. That's right.
Powerful story about one of your, and a lot going on in 1964. People need to consider the context of the nation at the time of what was happening in our country. But just a powerful story about one of your roommates and his wedding. Tell that story real quick for us.
Charlie was one of my roommates. He came to me, and he was also flunking out, so I taught him how to study. And, of course, we became best buddies then. And during the senior week, he brought his fiance up, and I met her, and she was very pleasant. And he asked me to be in his wedding. And she went home and told everyone that I was going to be in the wedding. And being from the Deep South, there was a lot of pushback, and the word came down that he could not be in the wedding, he being me.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie told him that if I wasn't in the wedding, there wouldn't be a wedding. So they fought back and forth, and they finally accepted me. And when I showed up in town, everybody in town knew who I was, but they were all very pleasant to me, and I was in the wedding. But that was an example of the bond that developed between us. A lot of my classmates were from the Deep South. They had never been around blacks. And as we got to know each other, they would eventually say, oh, you're normal. You're just like us. But I can't take you home to meet my daddy because he'd kill both of us. So there was a lot of ingrained prejudice in the country. And that was just a sign of the times.
Wow. And I got to tell you, sir, for some of my generation, that just, I guess maybe thankfully, seems like such a foreign concept. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Marion Tony Marshall, 5 distinguished flying crosses during his service in Vietnam. And let me just tease you a little bit. What kind of a guy does a Veterans History Project interview wearing a South Park tie? You'll find out more when we come back. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're chatting with Tony Marshall, Tony served in our Air Force, much of it in Vietnam, retired as a lieutenant colonel eventually after he came back home. Tony, I teased before the break about there's a great, I encourage people to visit, there's a great program called the Veteran History Project where they have various interviews with different veterans. Your interview was fascinating. You were doing it wearing a South Park tie. Is that just you being a rebel, Tony, or is that what your wife picked out that day?
No, you took the words out of my mouth. I've always been sort of a rebel. So it's a tie that I like, even though I don't watch the show very much.
Well, I love the tie. And it's pretty clear from just sort of getting to know you, you, like me, sir, are someone who takes particular delight in pushing boundaries. And that will come out as we go further on to our, through our discussion. You, in that interview, Tony, you mentioned that you, 90 to 95% of the men who were incarcerated, your fellow POWs were there because that they did something stupid. Does that include pulling out your camera and taking photos in the middle of combat, or did you get a pass on that one?
No. That didn't, as far as I know, didn't contribute to my little incident, but it was sort of a dumb thing to do, but yeah, I loved it.
Now, the F-4, Tony, we've had the fellow, the Navy guy who was tasked with founding the Top Gun School, and he talked a lot about the techniques that they had to develop for the F-4. When you were there, did that aircraft actually have a gun, or was this pre-gun?
No, we had the gun toward the end of my tour.
Okay, but this, would you consider that a dogfighter, though?
Yes.
Okay.
It's a dogfighter. The interesting thing there is each airplane has its own strengths and weaknesses, so you try to exploit your strengths while exploiting the enemy's weakness.
Okay. Now, you, as I mentioned, five Distinguished Flying Cross Awards in 9 months. From 8th August 71 through April 16th, 1972. And that citation in particular, Tony, says that it called it the most important attack mission in 4 years in the vicinity of Hanoi. But as you mentioned before, what led to your incident, I use the air quotes, was actually a mechanical failure, correct? Not a shoot down.
We think it was a mechanical failure. We think the nose cone on the center line collapsed and put the airplane out of control. But we had no business being that low. And just to put it in a capsule, our job was to fire a rocket with white phosphorus smoke to indicate the target and then go back up in orbit. On that last pass, we put the rocket on the ground. And I got a tape later from one of the guys that we were supporting. And on the tape, you can hear that we are still proceeding down. And my pilot was calling corrections off the smoke. And then, of course, the pilot that was watching us saw something white come off the airplane, puff of vapor, and then the airplane hit the ground. So it was just that quick. And in reconstructing it, we figured we were about 3,500 feet above the ground, below the small arms limit, which was 4,500 feet. Small arms go up to 4,500 feet. And that's where most of the airplanes that got shot down ended up biting the bullet. You don't need to go down there very often. We had no business going that low.
Talk a little bit about, because one thing I learned is, particularly in your aircraft where you have a front seater and a back seater, the relationship and the trust and the communication between front and back is essential. And your pilot on that mission, he had sort of a unsavory reputation, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He was sort of the maverick type in Top Gun. He liked to do things his way. In particular, he liked to strafe, which is using the gun, which means you have to go down low. And that may be what he was attempting to do on that last pass. But he had that reputation. Everyone in the shop had told him to knock it off because he went after a favorite target, which is also stupid. You get predictable.
Mm-hmm.
And before the mission, I had told him that in no uncertain terms would I put up with that. and he agreed. And then, of course, he went after it when we got airborne anyway. And at that point, I had made up my mind I would never fly with him again. Unfortunately, we never got to exercise that option.
Yeah, that fate determined that for you. Now, are you both the same rank, or is he outrank you, or how does that work?
Well, as a pilot, he automatically outranked me, but he was a captain, I was a captain.
Okay.
So we were the same rank. But you have that trust when you give your word that you're not going to do something, you don't do it. And another indication is we had a ejection handle in the back seat. If it was vertical, I could leave the airplane and he would stay. If it was horizontal, if I pulled my handle, he came right after I did. So that was another matter of trust. And he did not want that handle rotated. So, and again, a lot of pilots did not trust the back seater. So they said, do not rotate the handle. But again, that was something we established before we took off, because if I had to go, I wouldn't have time to rotate the handle normally.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in this case, you're flying along and next thing you know, you're out, right?
Yeah.
Well, I guess the next thing you knew, you were on the ground, Tony.
Well, the stupid thing is, because I was carrying my camera, I was changing a roll of film after the last call to fire the rocket. That was my last duty, was to call the altitude to fire the rocket. I did that, and I proceeded to change a roll of film because I expected a great fireworks show. So I didn't notice that he was still going down. And the first thing I remember is I heard an explosion, which was the canopy initiator firing the canopy off the airplane. But my feeble brain said, you heard something, but you didn't feel anything. And the next thing I know, the world went white because I peeped up over the canopy rail at least 500 miles an hour, and I did not have my visor down. So I got a good blast in the eyes. And then the next thing I know, I'm on the ground. So I missed the entire seat separation and parachute deployment, although we only got one swing in the chute, as near as we can tell.
And is it in the F-4, is it a single canopy for the entire cockpit, or are there separate canopies front and back?
Separate canopies.
Okay.
Separate canopies.
So
my canopy goes, I go, his canopy goes, he goes.
So you, next thing you know, you see in your mind's eye some knucklehead standing on a hill in Vietnam talking on his radio, and turns out it was you.
Yeah, that was my out-of-body experience. And in fact, they told me later that I was just babbling away on the radio, and they finally told me to shut up and give one click for yes, one click for no when they asked me questions. So I was in total shock. I was not expecting the ejection again. Naive.
What's interesting to me, Tony, though, is you mentioned, though, you know, life didn't flash before your eyes, but that when you sort of got your faculties back, you were just really upset.
I was PO'd, not just upset. And the reason was, I thought they were going to shoot me. And I went through this mental process of, I'm over here in an undeclared war. I'm almost geographically as far as I can get from home on the globe. And I'm going to die out here in the bushes like some sort of rabid dog. And nobody's going to know what really happened. And worst of all, nobody could do anything about it. That really PO'd me.
Well, you had a very powerful handgun at your side, fully loaded, didn't you?
I had a stupid 38, which is the most useless weapon to carry. Now, you can imagine you're firing a cap gun in a situation where people have AK-47s. So, you know, that thing is useless. I didn't carry it loaded, because I didn't want to come down in a parachute and possibly blow my foot off.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, there's no chance of shooting anybody.
Tony, when we come back, I'd like to talk about such a great part of your story. We've had lots of Vietnam POWs on the show before, but your story is different for a lot of reasons, and I think a lot of it has to do with the guy, the kind of guy that wears a South Park tie for for an interview. So when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about that, maybe have you introduce us to UGG a little bit and share your stories about him. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking with Tony Marshall. He completed 268.5 combat missions in Vietnam. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're very honored to be joined by Tony Marshall. Tony was awarded no less than 5 Distinguished Flying Cross medals in addition to the Purple Heart and other awards for his time in Vietnam. Tony, I can't help but want to ask this question. That 5 DFCs, that's a ton, is it not? I mean, what am I missing here?
I guess for a year and a half tour, I don't think it's too many. You get on certain missions that qualify for it. So I would say it's about average.
Okay. Well, we're thrilled to have you either way. Did you ever cross paths with Robin Olds? Was he at Udon with you at that same time? Or
he was at Ubon.
Ubon, okay.
Yeah, so never crossed paths with him.
Okay. Couple of things I learned. Well, let me back up a little bit because I can't get off that South Park tie. I love it so much. So, you had said in an interview that Tony can rationalize almost anything. So you don't carry ammunition in your sidearm. You were caught immediately during SEER training. And you could not swim worth a lick, but your main escape plan involved getting into a river and then swimming out to, what, the 7th Fleet?
Yep.
How does a guy like that survive?
He wouldn't. That was another product of stupidity.
Well,
when I was in shock, I came up with some weird ideas. But, you know, when you're in that situation, you're grasping for straws.
So you end up being, and I find it interesting, sir, that you refer to it as jail. You had pretty well rehearsed being I don't want to say a troublemaker, but someone who likes to push the boundaries. You had rehearsed this entire tale just in case you got caught. The folks at SEER training said it would never work, but Tony decided to give it a try anyway.
Yeah. I had gone through 3 layers of survival and SEER training. And the war was over before I got shot down. We knew that. We were going to pull out of there. And the reason was the bad guys didn't give up the plane of jars when the dry season came. But that was my clue that this was the last bit of the war and we were going to be out of there. So I adopted a stance of this is graduate level survival school. Why not try to see what I can get away with? And again, like I said, I can rationalize anything. And one of my deepest rationalizations is if anything happens to you, it's your fault. You take responsibility for your actions. So I decided to become a pilot. I decided I wanted fighters. I fought and scrambled to get to combat. So if anything happens to me, whose fault is it? It's your fault. Now, obviously, nothing's going to happen to me because when I was in jungle survival school, they said, take a look at the guy sitting next to you on either side because one out of 3 is going to have an abnormal tour. Abnormal being shot down and rescued, shot down and killed, or shot down and POW. And I looked at the 2 guys next to me. And of course, they were looking at me.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Tony, you mentioned that, or I learned in preparing here that there was, well, 2 things. One is apparently on our side, there was a prioritization when it came to rescues. And in the case of a 2-seater, their first priority was the pilot and the backseater was the second priority. The Vietnamese had a sort of a different take on that. They only got rewarded for turning in the first American aviator,
right.
And if there was 4 more, that was not a good situation for them, yeah?
No, because if you blinked wrong, you could be shot. They were very simplistic in their thinking. 1 pilot, 1 airplane. So if an airplane goes down, the government said you had to turn the pilot over unharmed, whereas the villagers, in a lot of cases, like to take out their frustrations on the crew members. But yeah, they would. They always rescued Alpha, being the pilot first. Then they went down the line: Bravo, Charlie, Delta. So they would fly over a backseater to pick up a frontseater.
Wow.
That's the choice you pay for being a second-class citizen.
Oh, okay. A lot of learning for me as well, and I don't know, if you, in your career, you went back and maybe taught at some of the Sears School, but you, by virtue of your sort of rebelliousness, you appeared to learn some lessons pretty quick. The fact was, if you did, and I think in the interview you said, well, don't, of your captors, you know, don't ask questions that force me to say no, because naturally I'm going to say no. But the other side of that was, if you gave them something that satisfied them, then you could move on to the next step.
Yeah, that was one of the basic tenets, I guess, of the Oriental thinking, is saving face. So if they got an answer, they saved face. If they didn't get an answer, then they had to beat you. Not always true, but in most cases, particularly at the end of the war, that was very easy to get away with just giving them an answer. So, you know, if you say your name is Donald Duck, well, they're happy.
And
I got quite a few lies in there, and they actually published a lot of the lies.
So was this kind of along the lines of all the folks that signed the confession letter, including who? George Washington, Willie Nelson?
Yeah.
So, you know, Bruce Wayne maybe was in that mix? I don't know.
No, the names were legitimate, but their take was anybody named Willie or Thomas Jefferson or George Washington was black. And, you know, I asked him what he thought about Willie Nelson and Willie Shoemaker, and that they didn't know they were black. But, of course, that went over his head. And go ahead.
Well, interesting cast of characters. Ugg, I think you guys nicknamed him. And
yes.
There was another fellow, I think you called him, that was the rule maker or the...
Felau. Well, no, there were three.
Okay.
There were more than three. But we had two guards, Felau, who was a prima donna and didn't like to get his hands dirty, Ugg, who was one step above Cro-Magnon, and then there was the rules man who doled out our packages, and then there was Plato, who was the genius who knew Americans better than we did.
Mm-hmm. Who accused Martin Luther King of being a violent extremist.
Yes. And Julian Bond of being an old man. And he backed it up with references from Coretta Scott King's book, which he misinterpreted. But I let him believe him.
What struck me as interesting, particularly with Ugg and some of these other guys, just a little. I mean, it seems like they. In fact, I encourage people to look you up on the interweb and see some of your presentations. And one of them, you got a slide that talks about the battles, and you talk about the battles you won, the battles you lost. One of them involved the point where they actually gave you finally an opportunity to write home, and like a good editor, that letter went through four or five rewrites before. And I the thing I love about you, sir, is I picture a POW here in Vietnam during war, and you're negotiating with these guys. I mean,
and they left themselves open to it. They would ask me something. How would you like to do this? Well, I wouldn't, or I would. Okay, I would like to do it, but you can't change anything I write. And instead of popping me upside the head, they said, okay. It was very interesting. They asked me, would you like to meet some MiG pilots? Oh, okay. What choice do I have?
Mm-hmm.
And they, they brought out a map and wanted me to trace my route, and I doodled all over the map and everything. They were quite happy because that's not what they wanted anyway. They wanted to know what I knew about MiG sweeps, which was Robin Olds' tactic to draw them up and shoot them down. And, I said, I don't know anything about that because I just got here. And since you guys said we're all murderers and rapists and all we do is go downtown and chase women, I like chasing women. That's where I am at night. So I don't hear anything the guys say in the bar.
And you got away with that.
Got away with that.
I wish I could see a picture of that map you produced, because it sounds like it was quite the piece of artwork.
It was.
It's amazing that an F-4 had that much fuel to fly halfway across Southeast Asia and back.
Well, we refueled in between, so I even included the tanker tracks on there.
You, to some extent, sir, you think a lot of the reason was the context of when you were captured. So you were a prisoner of war, if I'm not mistaken, for about 270 days, but it really was at a point where they knew this thing was coming to an end, and they wanted to, as you mentioned, they wanted to save face and put on the best faces possible for the public, for the U.S.,
yes,
for whomever.
And another interesting concept from them is they tend to remember the last thing that happened, and they were quite miffed when the folks that had been there for 6-7 years came home and started talking about torture. And they were saying, well, we treated you nice the last month. What's your problem? And again, another story on this. When I was during my initial interrogation, I told them I had just got there. It was my first mission. And they said, of course, it was his last one. But I told a bunch of lies, but it came out that I had a girlfriend who looked like Angela Davis. I made that up. And they said, of course, I was a supporter of Angela Davis because that suited their propaganda needs. And then because the subject of girlfriends was intriguing to them, because according to them, you know, your parents chose your spouse, I made up 14 or so girlfriends on the way up to Hanoi. And I got bored with that story, so I created a wife and a kid. And I had my mother send me a picture of my goddaughter. The upshot of that is, when they released me, they gave me my wedding ring because they didn't want to be accused of stealing it.
And, of course, the wrinkle here is you were not married.
I was not married, and the wedding ring actually belonged to my pilot. And, you know, they scooped up everything from the crash site and the captures, put it all in a warehouse in Hanoi, and when it came time to let us go, his and mine were commingled. And they said, well, let's give him his wedding ring. And they very reluctantly, and in my case, never, came back and said, well, you said this yesterday, now you're saying this today. It's just a matter of saving face. They just went along with everything.
Hmm. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, having a wonderful chat with Tony Marshall. Tony was a POW in Vietnam for 270 days. Just some great stories, a great storyteller. Tony, I hope you think about maybe doing a screenplay. This would make a great movie. Stick around, folks. We'll be back with more from Tony in just a second. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Tony Marshall about his experience in Vietnam and a little bit after it. Tony, before we get off that, just to clarify, what did you ever find out what happened to your pilot? I'm guessing he didn't make it.
He did not make it. There are two stories surrounding the ejection. The official story for release was that when night came, they said he would bed down for the night and he would see them in the morning, that the rescue folks would come back in the morning. I found out later from one of the guys that was airborne at the time, they heard a lot of gunfire over his radio and then they were not talking to him anymore. So the assumption is, being impulsive, he decided to shoot it out with him to avoid capture. And the sad part about that is you hear about the one or two people that shot their way out and got rescued, but you don't hear about the 98 that tried that and it backfired on them.
So, but we do know that he got out of the aircraft.
Oh, yeah. He was talking to them on the ground.
Okay.
And we know that the Vietnamese caught him because they corrected their statement and put his correct name in there after I gave them a bastardized version of his name.
I want to come back to the win-loss, this chart you put up, Tony, that had your wins, your losses, and your ties of your battles. I saw a photo of you, and I don't know when it was, maybe it's after you arrived back in the States or something, but let's just say your hair was not probably to regulation.
They came in about 2 months into the incarceration and said, everybody needs to get a haircut. So we lined up. I worked my way to the back of the line, kept working my way to the back of the line, hoping they wouldn't notice. But they said, nope, you have to get a haircut. And I packed my afro down and said, no, I don't need a haircut. And the guy said, well, but it's the camp regulations. Everyone needs a haircut. And then he started negotiating. He said, I cut Norris Charles's hair, who was the other black guy in the camp. And I said, I know, I've seen his head, and you're not touching mine. And he let it go. And then the next time he came, I took the clippers from him. I became the barber. So it never came up again. So, yeah, I had an afro that was way out of limits. And I didn't think anybody had the guts to tell me to get a haircut, but my old commander from MacDill did when I got to Andrews. He said, hi, welcome home, get a haircut. I said, yes, sir.
No negotiation there.
No negotiation there. You got to respect that.
So Tony Marshall wasn't quite done yet. You actually, and honestly, you're the first fellow or woman I've had on the show, Tony, that had his very own Forrest Gump moment. In this case, with President Nixon, share that great story with us.
Well, we were all invited to the White House, which, okay, that's great. But Nixon was on his way out, and we were on our way in. And I thought, this is boring. So the procedure is you go down the receiving line. You talk to a person. He tells the person next to him your name. The person tells the president your name. And then the president mumbles the same thing to everybody. Hi, welcome home. Hi, welcome home. And I thought this was boring, so I gave my camera to the guy in front of me, two people in front of me, and said, just take pictures. So I told the person my name. He told the person my name. The person told President Nixon my name. And he said, hi, welcome home. Thank you. And when he went to release his grip, I tightened my grip. And that moment was captured in film. And he didn't know what to do, but then he recovered very quickly. And he said, we're having a party in Georgetown, and you're invited. I thought, very good, Mr. President. And I let his hand go. But that was just, Forrest Gump, and I got to meet the president again. I couldn't pass up a chance to mess with the president.
The commander-in-chief, Tony.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Did you get to the party?
No, I didn't go to the party.
Okay, well, fair enough. Now, the nice thing about all this is eventually you did get the opportunity to sit in the front seat to fly.
Yes. They, of course, asked me what I wanted to do, and I simply replied the same thing I've always been asking to do, to go to pilot training. So they allowed me to go, and I eventually transitioned to the front seat, which was what I had been looking for all along.
And so how many years between the academy to when you finally got the chance to take the yoke or the stick?
6 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Patience is a virtue.
Yes, it is.
How?
Because the cutoff was age 27 and a half. If you don't make it by then, you're not going to make it. So my timing was good.
Was that pretty standard if you all the POWs got sort of their choice of next duty?
Yes.
Or, okay.
Yes.
Interesting. What now? We're running out of time, unfortunately. It always happens when we have great guests, Tony. But I want to talk a little bit about your time afterwards because I saw an interview when people asked, you went on to fly commercially as a pilot, but like a lot of military members I've had on the show, I've heard you say, you know, I'd go back and do it all over again, despite everything that happened. But the camaraderie is key to what you miss.
Yes. Most of my friends are former military. It's a bond that the civilian world just cannot appreciate. You go to remote bases, you bond. You get to know their family. They get to know your family. If there's a time of need, they're there for you. It's just a unique family situation. I love it. And, you know, when your life depends on the actions of other people, you don't worry about what color they are, what religion they are. You know, you get a respect for the person's ability. And, again, that's the way it's filtered out. If you can cut it and do the job, you're accepted, respected. If you can't, you're out. And that's the bottom line.
Well, the reason that really jumped out at me, sir, is I mean, that really cuts to the entire mission and the objective. And the reason we do American Warrior Radio is to be a translator for those civilians out there who just, and you're right, unless you've been there, worn the uniform, been in the line of fire, we civilians, we can't comprehend. And so it's important to continue to have folks like you to share those messages, Tony. What other things, talking to young people now, I know you do a lot of volunteers in the local schools. What are the thoughts would you share for those folks listening out there who might be considering joining, or just in general in life, about work ethic and discipline and all the stuff you learned in the military?
I think the biggest lesson is just taking responsibility for your actions. And with rights come responsibilities. So we have a lot of people now preaching they have a right not to wear a mask, but they don't think about the responsibility of protecting other people. I think we've gone way overboard in the individual rights compared to the group rights. So my message to people is think about your actions, think about how they affect other people, and take responsibility for your actions. I don't apologize for very much I do. I can't think of anything I apologize for, because I think it out and I mean it when I do it. So if someone steps on my foot accidentally, there's no need to say, I'm sorry, it's an accident. If they do it on purpose, that's a different story. So that's my philosophy on life.
Tony, do you think that philosophy is, it's almost like that's been lost. I hate to say
it. It has. Oh, it has been lost. You know, if we see someone in trouble now, instead of helping them, we take out a camera and start taking pictures. You know, trying to get 15 seconds of fame.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, sir, I'm glad that we were able to get 43 minutes of fame with you. Really appreciate your time with us, and thank you for your service, Tony.
My pleasure.
And welcome home.
All right. Thanks, Ben.
Ladies and gentlemen, another great show. You can find this and over 270 other interviews at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. We're on Spotify. You can find us anywhere. Please. Find these messages, share them with your friends and family so they can be heard. Until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place.